Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome. It's Friday, March 18th, 2011, and today we're talking with longtime ChrisMartinson.com member, Dogs in a Pile, although his friends call him Rick. His knowledgeable posts have long been valued by the community here, but never so much as in the past week, when he has posted some of the most useful observations and explanations of the nuclear situation unfolding in Japan, perhaps found anywhere on the internet. Rick is an expert in the nuclear field. He's a retired Navy officer with over 20 years of experience, most of that on nuclear-powered submarines. He's a certified nuclear engineer, which means he's certified to operate, maintain, and oversee nuclear facilities. He also has extensive expertise on nuclear weaponry. I've asked Rick here today to help clarify and demystify the haze of incomplete and erroneous information circulating in the media all this week. Hopefully, after listening to this interview, you'll have a better sense of what nuclear power is, how it works, what's likely happening at the Fukushima reactor in Japan, and what you should and shouldn't be concerned about right now. Welcome, Rick. Thanks so much for joining us on such short notice.
Glad to be here, Chris.
So, can you tell us about your background as a nuclear engineer?
Sure. Briefly, just coming out of the Naval Academy, I selected submarine service as my community to serve in. You have an option of serving in either the air, surface, or nuclear power field, and I went submarines. Then went through a year of extensive schooling, which was 6 months of classroom that worked out to about 650 credit hours equivalent. So it was pretty much a focused, concentrated effort in the pertinent areas: core materials, theory, thermodynamics, heat transfer, water chemistry, radiochemistry, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, the whole gamut that would apply. And that was over a six-month period. Then we are sent off to a prototype, an actual operating reactor plant, where we qualify as an engineer to oversee the operation. And you basically have to have a detailed knowledge of every system that it takes to operate the plant so that you can correctly and ably supervise the workers that are operating the plant. Then is you get sent off to your first ship, and you essentially repeat the process. Most guys go to a different type of reactor plant than what they qualified on as a student, just because the Navy has several different types of prototype plants and only a few types of propulsion plants on the boats. So then you qualify there, and you just essentially reinforce that over your career. And depending on the specific job you're assigned to, you're going to be given the responsibility to run a division of guys that support the operation and maintenance of the plant, whether it's the mechanical systems, the electronic systems, the chemistry, whatnot, or the auxiliary systems, and then you operate the plant.
Right, and so they train you obviously in how to run it during good moments, and I assume you train for accidents as well.
We actually spend probably a third of our time in a drill scenario, and they do the same thing at commercial plants. You know, obviously they can't have the downtime because they're there to produce electricity. So operating a commercial power plant, you have to have that continuous operation at power. The submarine world, the operation of the plant is much more transient. You're under different operating conditions. You may be operating at lower speeds, at lower reactor powers, and then as you increase speed and you're driving the ship around, at higher powers. But there's just a little bit of a dynamic there that commercial plants don't see. We produce the power for both electrical power generation and propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
We produce steam for propulsion, and all of that is interconnected, and it's just another element that you have to understand. It's, in theory, it's no different than what the guys at a commercial plant are doing, the different dynamics. But we drill extensively. Each watch team will usually get about 4 to 6 hours of hardcore drilling a week, and the entire crew is drilled, and we're talking about, you know, a minor drill, like an instrumentation problem, all the way down to, you know, flooding in the engine room, a compounded casualty that shuts down the reactor, and then how you have to respond to that. And in addition, it's related, but it's not necessarily nuclear power. Because of the generation of contaminated material in radioactive waste, we also do quite a bit of drilling on what to do in the event of a radioactive liquid spill or a fire involving radioactive material, and just how you have to go about combating those types of casualties. Much like what the guys and gals at the civilian plants are going through. They have an extensive qualification process that also includes drilling in both, you know, casualty and normal operating scenarios.
Right. So the operators certainly at the Fukushima plant, they're like all operators. They've been through extensive training. They've been through disaster modeling. They've been through their scenarios. They've done all of that. Tell us about what you think probably happened. So Friday, this enormous earthquake strikes. A tsunami comes ripping through. Tell us about what those first moments are like for them and what they were probably doing. And hopefully that'll give us some indication of what state the reactors were in when they started to go. We heard about the trouble later in the week on Saturday and Sunday.
Well, it's my understanding that three of the six plants were operating and three of them were in a maintenance shutdown. That's just based on what I've been able to pull out of the news. But they operate separately. I mean, I'm sure there's some interconnectivity with some emergency fill systems. I'm guessing here, but I could imagine that at about 2:46, they were sitting just basically doing nothing except monitoring their panels, monitoring their instrumentation, and making sure that the plant was operating as it was intended to operate. Reactor power plants are not very dynamic unless something is happening. So nothing is going to just come along and change power levels. So monitoring your instrumentation, you sit there and you watch it, and it's just like you're driving your car down the road. You periodically scan your instrumentation, make sure that you're getting enough electrical output, make sure that your coolant temperatures and oil levels are. You just watch and make sure that nothing surprises you.
Yep.
So here they are, they're sitting at the panels, and the earthquake starts. Well, I mean, everybody knows that Japan's in the Ring of Fire, so an earthquake in and of itself probably starts out as, okay, here it comes. I wouldn't say that you ever get used to it, but you probably get a little bit, you know, skeptical. All right, this one's going to shake. And the expectation was this is nothing out of the ordinary, and it'll shake, and it'll end soon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certain they have protocols in place that, you know, if they have a seismic event, if they have an earthquake, that you have to go and do visual inspections of piping systems just to make sure that everything's okay. Well, then about 30 seconds into this, they quickly realized that this was not a normal event. I've seen reports that said the reactors were automatically shut down. And what happens there is either the operators insert the control rods to stop the critical reaction, or they have sensing equipment that automatically inserts control rods. Because you want to put the reactor in its most stable, safe condition, which is shut down. You know, the problem is it's much worse if you can't get the reactor shut down. So that's the first step, placing it in a shutdown condition. Then the immediate concern would be, okay, you know, what's going on? This was a big quake. A lot of stuff got shaken around, checking instrumentation, making sure that all the systems were operating as they were intended to. And at this point, the commercial power plant produces site power. It produces its own power, and that's what you run your pumps with. So there was the emergency procedures were broken out. Since the reactor was shut down, it's no longer producing steam, it's no longer turning turbines, it's no longer generating electricity, you have to shift to an alternate supply. So the diesel emergency diesel generators they had on site started up and were providing electricity, and their pumps were continuing to run. They were continuing to circulate cooling water through the reactor and removing decay heat. Then the tsunami comes along, and we've all seen from the pictures that Fukushima Daiichi is right on the coast, and I heard one report that was later confirmed that a 35-foot wall of water hit the plant, and unless these diesel generators were on the top of buildings or otherwise encased in a concrete building, they were going to get damaged, or you had the risk of getting seawater damage. And as robust as, you know, people think a diesel is, some of these diesels might have had damage following the earthquake where they couldn't start. There's a lot of redundancy in the system. So if one diesel generator will run all your electrical needs and electrical loads, you probably have three, you know, in the event one doesn't start, or as you have to, you know, periodically shut them down and take them offline to do preventive maintenance. So we don't really know the extent of that yet, whether or not all the diesels were running or some of the diesels were running or none of the diesels were running. But the reports I've seen and I've heard was some diesels were running for some amount of time when the tsunami hit, either through destroying the electrical distribution that came into the plants or the diesels themselves. They lost that ability to power the pumps.
I got an email from somebody in the region who said that the news report they had gotten was that they have two redundant electrical switching substations that the diesel would feed into those, and then these redundant substations would then parcel that electricity out to pumps in other places. Those were apparently located in the basement, both of them, and they just got destroyed by the tsunami because of the seawater effect. So I heard that was part of the catastrophe as it unfolded.
Okay. Well, then we got reports that they were having problems with the diesels, either them working, them making electricity, or the electricity being distributed, which would be, you know, consistent with what we've seen. And then they had a secondary emergency power supply with batteries, and those ran for some amount of time. Well, the assumption, you know, and in hindsight now, it's, you know, probably looking back that you didn't really plan for the worst case event. Once the battery was depleted, that was it. The pumps had no power. And unless the plants have inherent natural circulation heat removal design, they're going to start to heat up. So you have, you know, three things happening. You have, you know, an earthquake, you have a tsunami, and then that it causes loss of power. And then your three levels of power generation are now gone. You would imagine that the tsunami wiped out external grid power, or at least the ability to get it to the site, because I'm sure they have the capability to tie in and get electrical energy from another source. But with the extent of the damage that we saw, I'm sure that substations were just destroyed. So now these guys are on a clock. They knew what their core operating history was. They knew what the decay heat rate was going to be like. They knew the amount of time that they had, theoretically, to start removing decay heat by restoring circulation.
Can you just explain decay heat very quickly?
Decay heat is, without going into a detailed discussion of fission in general, when you have fission, you split a nucleus of a fuel particle, in this case uranium, it splits into two other particles, and it releases neutrons. And the neutrons go on, they populate through, and some are absorbed, some do nothing, some hit another uranium nucleus or a fuel nucleus, and it generates, and under the right conditions, you produce a steady-state neutron population that continues to propagate and produce the heat that you need to produce the steam. Well, in that process, when these fission products result, they themselves are radioactive, and they will undergo a decay process, either a beta or a gamma, or in some cases, a lower energy neutron decay. But this will happen for some time. They'll have a half-life, and depending on what the radionuclide is, it has to go through that decay to get to a lower energy state. It's that process of fission and the ejection of these different radioactive particles that continue to generate heat, even though the critical reaction is shut down. You may shut down your neutron generation, but you're going to have significant beta and gamma decay within these fission products and the decay of just the activated components of the fuel and the fuel assemblies that are within the core. So,
sure. So this is what I felt was important for. I've seen some confusion around this point where people say, well, but they shut them down. And so the shutting down is shutting down the critical reaction, which is the neutron cascade, which is what we call fission. But even once you stop that and you've got all the control rods in place, there's still these residual processes where things that have been bumped around still have to decay themselves. That decay heat is what they were struggling to get rid of all this week. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And that's not an insignificant problem. Given the amount of fuel in a power unit, in a reactor, depending on your power history and how long you've been at a steady state power level, even though you shut down, immediately following shutdown, you're looking at between 5 to 7% of whatever your pre-shutdown power history was. So I think the units 1, 2, and 3 were, or 1, 2, and 4 were 5,000 megawatt units. You know, if they had been operating at full power, and I mean that's the most efficient operation of a commercial power plant, high power and just continue to pump out steam and electricity. You do the math. You're still looking at a significant heat generation immediately following shutdown, and you know it's 5,000 megawatts. Even if you're only at 2.5% or 1%, that's a lot of heat, and you have to remove that. So what happens inside the plant now is this decay heat is building up, and these reactors are closed systems. They're either a pressurized water reactor or a boiling water reactor, and what that means is there's boiling that occurs in the core. That's a design feature because boiling and turbulent flow is really good at removing heat. It just has some special concerns with it in terms of how you operate the plant and how you design the plant. But basically, you have a pressurized closed system so that you can have this water in a liquid state at very high temperatures, 400, 500, 600 degrees, depending on the plant design. So you have a closed system, and you're adding energy to it. Well, in a closed system, you increase the heat, you're going to increase the pressure. That's what happens. Everybody's familiar with the heat transfer equations. It's the same concept as a pressure cooker. You know, depending on which of the little relief thingies you stick on the top, it's going to get hotter and it's going to cook your broccoli faster. So same thing's going on here. The pressure's going up. So now you've got two concerns. You've got a buildup of heat, and you're decreasing your margins to the cladding, the fuel, and the conditions under which it was designed to operate, and you're starting to stress the system. So long before they would do that, you've got plants, they're designed with pressure relief valves, and when you get to certain pressure conditions, those relief valves will lift, and in most cases, the water is collected within the primary containment boundary, or it's sent to a tank where it is collected. They don't just vent to the atmosphere unless you're in the most dire circumstances, so hold that thought. So I'm sure they got to the point where they were lifting relief valves to lower the pressure, lower the temperature, trying to figure out what was going on. And the whole time, they're building up temperature because they don't have power. They can't run their pumps. They can't remove decay heat. Well, at some point, they got to where you are continually venting this reactor vessel in the core and the coolant, and you're essentially degassing. And what happens here is part of the water chemistry and radiochemistry. Hydrogen is used in the plant to maintain pH and the corrosive properties or not of the water. So as you depressurize this water, hydrogen will come out of solution. And under normal operating conditions, that's a very controlled procedure. You degas, the hydrogen comes out, and you either, in our case, we just bubbled it overboard, subject to geographical constraints and proximity to land, but very controlled procedure. We got rid of it. But if you're doing this as your only means of pressure and temperature control, you're going to start to accumulate hydrogen. And as we saw, there were explosions, and it was pretty clear right off the bat that the only source that it could be was an accumulation of hydrogen, and that was pretty consistent. I think the situation inside the plants was a lot more dire than we were getting news on, and I would also expect that You know, it'd be nice to be sending all this information out there, but it's not helping the guys in the plant. You know, they probably had notification protocols for their emergency response and disaster response. But this, we're talking about a normal, the only event is an event at the reactor plant type of situation, and that was not the case. You just had a 9.0 earthquake and a tsunami, so whatever disaster relief and emergency response was going on external to the plant was absolutely swamped. So it's possible that a report came in and was lost. Who really knows? Hopefully a lessons learned critique will happen afterwards, and you know, what can we learn from this? But I'm sure those guys knew that it was bad as soon as they saw that they had no electrical power to run their cooling pumps.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. Now they're venting, now they're degassing, now they're accumulating and concentrating hydrogen. And there's no doubt in my mind that these guys just sat there going, we know what's going to happen. We have to vent. And then we saw the subsequent explosions. So, you know, at this point, they still haven't had any flow restored. So that your concern becomes the integrity of the fuel assemblies. And at some point, you're just going to exceed the temperatures at which they were supposed to operate, or the range of temperature they were supposed to operate at. And now you start having blistering as the you start to accumulate fission product gases inside the fuel matrix. You'll start to get buckling and bubbling and cracking of the fuel assembly. And in certain cases and conditions, they can get hot enough where they'll actually start to deform and melt, and hence meltdown.
Now, I assume this is because the water level has dropped below the top of the fuel assembly in some way because of all this venting we're doing. Every time we vent, we're clearly losing some fluid one way or the other.
Without the ability to add makeup water, when you vent, you're losing water level. But actually, the reason why you're venting is because you've drawn a bubble in the core. You've boiled away the water in the core. So probably, at some point within a couple of days, if not less, I'm sure they had bubbles in the core. Now, fortunately, it was a pressure or a boiling water reactor, so it was designed to have some portion of the core uncovered, probably the upper portion, and the fuel assemblies there are constructed so that the upper parts of the fuel rods have less fuel in them just because they're going to be uncovered or partially covered or subject to a steam and water interface. But they're losing water level. And now you've got the risk of hydrogen accumulating in the top of the core, like what happened at Three Mile Island. And fortunately, that was contained within the primary boundary inside the pressure vessel or the core pressure vessel itself that we know of. So we just don't know. My guess is these guys were their first steps were to vent within their primary containment boundary. And once that got full or you know, they reached either temperature-pressure relationship inside their primary containment or hydrogen levels, they had no choice but to start to vent into secondary containment, assuming that they had some form of secondary containment, which would be consistent with what we've seen with the diagrams and the reports that have come out.
So primary containment, they've got a big steel, 5.5-6-inch thick steel vessel. That's our inner pressure cooker. Then secondary, there's this big concrete thing that looks like an upside-down light bulb, the torus and all that, you know. And then there's the outer building, right? So when you're saying we're venting at this point, I assume you mean they're venting between the steel container and into that first concrete primary containment vessel.
Right. Without knowing the specifics of how that plant was constructed, I can only go with what we had.
Mm-hmm.
We had a pressure vessel in a primary system that was inside a reactor compartment. So the primary is the first containment boundary, and then the reactor compartment on the submarine is a secondary containment boundary.
Right, but then hydrogen had to get out into what we might call the tertiary or the third layer, right, because that's what we saw with the first reactor one when that blew up. That was a hydrogen explosion somewhere between the concrete and the outer building.
Right, I'm sure, you know, at that point in the progression of the casualty, they didn't start venting to that boundary until it became absolutely necessary. You know, you could have started venting to atmosphere almost immediately. But you've got to weigh the, you know, how much radioactivity do we release to the environment versus the expectation of when we might be able to restore cooling. You know, so you're not, that's not what you're going to go to first, starting to vent directly to the environment. You know, you're going to vent to the most contained boundary first, and then the next one, and if you have a third system, then you're going to go there. Well, at some point, hydrogen ignites, and it did, and, you know, that first explosion we saw on Unit 1, and then the really high-energy explosion on 3, which, I mean, I hate to speculate.
Please do. That one looked different to me. What are your ideas there?
It was either... They either got to the point where they were pinning relief valves shut and allowing temperature and pressure to go above whatever the design limit was for that boundary, or you saw a breach of that primary concrete boundary, because you actually saw chunks of concrete getting thrown up and out. My guess is that's probably what it was, is they actually broke the boundary, that inner boundary, whether it's their secondary containment, or that's probably what it was. You know, you see these the pictures where you have this big concrete dome. That's what I think happened.
Yeah, it was a huge amount of material, and just by eye, you know, it was ejected 600-700 feet into the air. That's a pretty high energy explosion right there.
And I mean, that could be the cause of a couple of things, or a combination. It could either be because the same mechanism of explosion, a hydrogen explosion, occurred at a much higher pressure, or it was something else. And I think what happened is they had a higher pressure, and when the hydrogen ignited, you know, you just need that first little stress crack in the concrete, and then the whole thing rapidly depressurizes from there. And I mean, that there was just so much energy behind that. It had to be because the initial pressure condition inside that boundary when the hydrogen ignited was higher, and it just let go.
Yeah, and the first reactions from the officials were, they said there had been no breach of the containment vessels, which was, you know, really puzzling to me, because I couldn't square that up with what I saw. And today they admitted that maybe things were a little further off than they thought. So I completely understand they were trying to manage a situation. I mean, that is clearly a bad moment in nuclear operation, right? I mean, that looked to me like a certified bad moment. What are the chances that released and scattered all kinds of material that we might call radioactive?
Oh, there's no doubt it did. Just the venting process alone is going to carry away entrained particulates, just normally occurring stuff that's supposed to be on the other side of the pipe. That stuff is supposed to be contained. But when you vent, now you're introducing that into, you know, a place where it's not normally supposed to be, maybe under a casualty control situation, but... when that thing exploded, the first two things that came to my mind was that had to be an inner containment boundary, you know, maybe not the primary itself, but, you know, that dome, that concrete dome, if that's how they were constructed. So it was a big explosion. It was not like what we saw before. And because of that, what damage to support systems, sampling systems, charging system, makeup water systems, could have possibly breached the primary and now allowed water to leak. And, you know, 600 degree water is not going to stay water for very long. When it hits atmosphere, it's going to vent. And almost right away, we saw continuous plumes of steam as systems were draining out. So, you know, now you've got a compounded situation where you're releasing particulate into the atmosphere, so you've got an airborne issue. You're depositing this stuff all over the place, so you're going to have a general radiation issue from the contaminated material. And if you're uncovering the core, you're losing shielding potentially, and you've got all kinds of issues with where this stuff is going and what's happening. Not to mention what you've got elsewhere in the building, and that gets us to these spent fuel pools.
If the cores get exposed, just before we move on to the spent fuel, because that's really the issue I've been focused on for a while. But so if they have a core, like in reactor 3, just speculating for a moment, they lost their primary concrete containment vessel, but inside that is the reactor core and its containment vessel. Assuming that's been breached in some way, what are the options then? What do you do at that point? It doesn't sound like there's any possibility of turning on a pump and covering it. At that point, you now have an exposed core. That could that go recritical? Meaning it could slip back into a neutron generating state that feeds off itself? Or what happens at this stage if what we've speculated about has actually happened there?
Well, if you've lost. And I'm going to differentiate between the primary boundary and a primary containment. You know, your primary boundary is your coolant piping, the pressure vessel, and that closed loop. Your primary containment is going to be the concrete building built around that. So if you've had a rupture of that primary containment boundary, which is probably what happened, you've had damage to those support systems. I would be surprised if there was a breach of the pressure vessel itself. I'd be pretty surprised, but let me couch that. You know, these things, as they get old, I mean, they're constructed of steel and iron alloys so that they have the properties of strength and ductility, so that you don't want to have a high carbon steel that's very, very tough but very, very brittle. These things have to be designed to be operated from a range of temperatures from, you know, basically ambient up to whatever temperature they see when they're operating. So you've got this metallurgical concern where you've got this, and I think this plant was installed in 74, if I remember correctly. You've had this thing that's basically been annealed for 30 years, and it becomes neutron embrittled. So it's possible that they had a brittle fracture of the core. Now, this, you know, it's not going to be like dumping liquid nitrogen on a piece of metal and hitting it with a hammer and having it shatter into a million pieces, but it's possible that you could crack it to the point where you're starting to expose the core directly to the environment. And your concern there is going to be streaming radiation, you know, because the pressure vessel does a pretty good job of shielding. But at power, it's not going to be, you know, it's going to, inside a reactor compartment at power, you're looking at levels that are going to exceed your lethal dose. But when you're shut down, that's not going to be the case. But when you expose that huge point source of radioactive material, you know, now you've got this potential for streaming radiation through a breach. All of that said, I'd be surprised to find out that there was a major breach of the pressure vessel. But at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised if they went in and found that had happened, given the age of the plant. You know, clearly that boundary was destroyed in the explosion, and there is nothing you can do to operate your normal piping systems unless, you know, you're just going to run your pumps at a pumping into to atmosphere. Then it just becomes an issue of dumping seawater on them. And that's kind of the part that's got me confused and puzzled a little bit, because they went to seawater quickly. The first report started coming in that they were pumping seawater in on Saturday, which tells me that they recognized right away that either the recovery was going to be long and they had to go to a backup system that was taking water directly from the ocean and pumping it in there, or they had no chance of getting any type of normal flow back, and they were attempting to fill the volume of that primary containment boundary just to cover the whole thing, cover the whole core and everything inside.
Well, yeah, they might have lost water. It might have been an admission that, you know, whatever their fresh water source was gone. It might have gotten tsunamied away from its storage tank or something. Who knows? But, you know, it might have been an admission that they actually had some cracks and they were leaking water out at a very early stage. But whatever, it seemed like by the time you make the instant decision to go to seawater, you've already run down a pretty long checklist of things that say you're not in a normal condition.
Absolutely. And I think it's probably safe to assume that the force of the explosion, perhaps even the earthquake itself, sheared off piping of enough size that before they could react, they lost enough water, or the where these pipes sheared is the resultant leaks were unisolable. You know, you get a crack in the pipe, you can't shut an isolation valve to keep the core covered.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt in my mind that they had plant damage either as a result of the earthquake or the explosion that caused leakage. You know, now whether it's controllable leakage, something that could be isolated, you know, quickly became a moot point because they went, we need to start pumping seawater.
Right.
And it's still unknown. At least I haven't seen anything that said that they were pumping this into the core or if they were pumping it into the primary containment building and it was working its way into the core through this cracked piping or sheared piping or you know, a breach in the pressure vessel itself. We just don't know yet.
Interesting. Okay, so leaving the core aside for a moment, because, gosh, that's an enormous difficulty. From what I've been seeing, it looks like certainly there was a huge issue at 3. I still don't have a clear sense of what's going on in 2 at this point, although they expressed greater concern about 2 than either of the other ones at one point. I think that was on Monday or so. But clearly there was an issue with 1. So 1, 2, and 3 were all full of issues. 4, I thought I was really surprised by because it was supposed to be in this maintenance shutdown. 5 and 6, also in maintenance shutdown. No issues there except they're watching the temperatures climb in the spent fuel pools. But it looks modest and controllable. But 4, surprised us all and actually suffered some sort of an explosive event, it looks like. And in that one, I think the story is completely around the spent fuel pools potentially. So the spent fuel pools are the places where they've taken all the old used up cores and they're storing them in water. In theory, their decay heat goes away, relatively rapidly at first and then tails off for a while. It's an exponential decay. And what could have happened in 4 that could have ignited an explosion in there? Is it possible for a spent fuel pool to generate hydrogen?
It can if it's hot enough, but you don't take the fuel out of the core until you've been shut down for long enough to reach in, grab the fuel assembly, and whatever mechanism they do. We've all seen pictures of the cranes, but you pull these things out in sections. You pick them up. They probably have a fuel handling container is what we had. You just pulled the fuel assembly up into that, and then you transferred it over to these spent fuel pools. But you're not going to shut down and 20 minutes later be snatching this thing out of the core, still with a 4 or 5% decay heat rate generation. You're going to shut down. You're going to get to a couple of days into this thing, and subject to procedures that have been developed and refined over the years. This is how you do a refueling. You're going to move the fuel to these pools. Well, you cover them with enough water, then just the natural convective circulation of that water, these fuel assemblies are going to heat up the water, hot air or hot water rises up and just dissipates naturally within these tanks. I've seen reports that they're 45 feet deep, which is consistent with what I've seen in my experience. So could you get to the point where they're boiling? I don't know if that's probably the right way to look at it. The concern would be, what did the earthquake do? Did it crack the concrete? Did it crack the steel liner? And did they lose water? Now, if you uncover these things, even after 2, 3, 4 months in there, they're still going to have a lot of decay heat. Well, that water's got, two functions. One, it allows that natural circulation to dissipate heat, but it also provides shielding. And if you take that shielding away, the immediate concern becomes getting the water level restored, but it's complicated by the fact that you've got this giant chunk of radioactive material radiating energy. We started the gamma spikes. To me, when we got reports of the gamma spikes and radiation levels going up, and they're 4 millirem or millisieverts or nanograys or whatever at the gate, that doesn't tell you anything. But when they evacuate people because of high radiation, there's some dynamic going on. Well, the fuel isn't doing anything except sitting there. So the only thing that could be changing is whether or not there was water covering it or not. Or they were slowly losing water and slowly losing shielding, and then, they got to the point where they had to call it and get out. So, depending on the core operating history and how long the spent fuel had been in there, you could boil the water, and in doing so, in this starts to get into core design. Zirconium absorbs hydrogen, and if you start to pull this, you know, the hydrogen in, I'm just at a loss to come up with a process where the water would be disassociated into hydrogen and oxygen so that you would have a hydrogen fire or you would have hydrogen embrittlement and then the fuel itself got hot enough to start to burn. I still can't get my brain around that.
Well, the temperatures would have to be enormous. I mean, you get a little bit of that dissociation at 1,000 degrees Celsius, but it really becomes active at 2,000, 2,500, 3,000 degrees. It takes a lot to dissociate water. But sake of argument, let's just imagine for a second that the spent fuel pool got cracked and it drained out. So you have these things sitting there. What happens next? So they're gamma radiating each other. They're slowly heating up. How would that possibly lead to an explosion?
Well, unless they were so old, and this is where it becomes a possibility, because zirconium absorbs hydrogen, if it started to release hydrogen as it got hotter and either started to deform or melt, or it got to the temperature where zirconium starts to emit the absorbed hydrogen, then you might start to see a hydrogen buildup to the point where you could have that explosion. The other possibility, as far as where the hydrogen came from, if it was indeed hydrogen that caused the explosion and the fire, was that you had, you know, hydrogen from the venting because you weren't able to cool that core. Now, you still would have to cool the core, but because it had been shut down, because if you think about it, you've got two pools of spent fuel. It's just that one is more spent than the other.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've lost the ability to remove decay heat from the spent fuel, because you can't add water to a tank that's basically at atmosphere, you've also got that concern with what's inside the plant. The core itself in 4 was not at atmosphere. I mean, it might have been essentially at atmosphere, but, you know, you've got decay heat removal issues that you've got to do, so you still have to do 4 circulation, until you're deep enough into that maintenance period where you've basically got your plant, you know, down to the point where it's cold. And, you know, cold is relative. Cold could be 240 degrees. Cold could be 80 degrees. You know, it just mm-hmm. It depends on where they were, what they were doing. But you've got not quite as spent fuel inside the power unit in the core that you need to worry about decay heat removal as well. So, you know, I don't know. But as far as, you know, criticality occurring, they use water to moderate the fast neutrons down to thermal energies to sustain the critical reaction. So without water, I can't foresee a circumstance where you would have a critical event in spent fuel. You know, they probably store these things with battens of neutron absorbers in the appropriate geometries. I doubt they put them back in the pools the way they put them in the core in terms of proximity to other cells or stacking or, you know, whatever the density might be. But what you could have, though, is if you had temperatures high enough that these things started to melt, that you could have, you know, chunks of fuel particles, because you don't consume all of the fuel. It's not like you drive your car until the gas tank's empty and then, you pull in and fill up. There's still quite a bit of fuel particles or pellets still rolled into these fuel assemblies. So, you know, it's possible that you could have a deformation and a melting and fuel particles come into close enough contact or a geometry enough to where, you know, this neutron that's just, you know, decaying away through a natural process triggers a neutron or two from a nucleus, and then you can get, you know, pockets of criticality. That theoretically could happen, but I think the whatever happened inside of 4 is still very unknown.
Yeah, I've heard some speculation that said, well, you know, they'd been really racking and re-racking these things because, you know, they were juggling them to try and squeeze a few more in the pools, because just like here, they didn't have any real good long-term place to put these things, and the reprocessing facilities, you know, could only handle so much. So they were racking and stacking, and you know, you could imagine them saying, okay, this is about as tight as we can get everything in here safely. And then you have this thing called a 9.0 earthquake, which, guess what? It might alter your geometries around a little bit. I mean, I know they build these things wonderfully, you know, to incredible design specs, but it doesn't mean that the building doesn't shake. You know, this thing wasn't isolated from the shaking. So things shook around in there. And so one speculation I read said, well, maybe these things kind of shook out of their normal geometry into some other geometry that wasn't so optimal. Or maybe it was optimal if what you're looking for is an increase in its ability to heat itself up.
And if that's the case, and even if it was just confined to, you know, within a couple of square inches or feet of that interface, now you're talking about temperatures and pressures and the radiolysis that produces hydrogen. So, you know, that is a possibility that happened to some extent. I just, you know, just based on experience, it would take an incredible stroke of not luck, but just the right sequence of wrong things to happen. But it's a possibility. We may find out that's indeed what happened. We don't know. You know, the other thought, I know there were some reports that said it was a fuel oil fire, which makes sense to a degree. I know when our plant was shut down, we had all kinds of containment and stuff built and staging and scaffolding. So you've got a lot of class alpha type fire stuff in there. And, you know, if they were storing fuel in there because either the fuel was irradiated or it was a mixed stream, you know, that they stored in there because they were going to dispose of it as radioactive waste as well, and that ignited. I don't know. You know, you could have had a whole bunch of hydrogen bottles and acetylene bottles up there. We just don't know. I almost hate to speculate, but in any event, it's pretty clear that they lost water. They uncovered the spent fuel. Now you've got this giant high radiation issue that complicates your casualty. You know, so here you have no pumps, you have no electricity, you have no ability to get water into the core. The core is heating up. The spent fuel is now a giant radiation source, preventing people from going in and figuring out what's going on and what the exact conditions are within the plant so that they can formulate a plan to fight this thing. You know, and the fact that they went to seawater as quickly as they did kind of, you know, makes me all but convinced that they knew it was bad almost from the get-go. You know, and then it became a matter of, like, can we get enough seawater into the primary containment boundary to cover everything up? You know, I would struggle to find an analogy that people who aren't familiar with the construction of a nuclear plant would understand. But, you know, I don't know, if you had a battery fire in your car, would you try to, you know, crack the hood and spray it with a hose, or would you just drive your car into a lake? You know, and driving your car into a lake is pretty much a last resort, but you're going to, you know, cover the whole mess and pretty much write it off. I don't know. It's when they went to seawater, that was essentially a decision to decommission the plants.
Yep. So let's talk about what can happen from here. Sort of maybe a best case, most likely, and then a worst case. So, I mean, clearly they're fighting fires on multiple fronts. You know, I think reactors 1, 2, 3, and 4 all present individual sort of challenges at this point, each of them in various stages of disasterness at this stage. But first of all, for the people of Japan, what is the chance then that they're going to be facing serious contamination, not, you know, radiation being the emission of a particle that travels some distance before it stops and it's over, but contamination being radioactive dust, chunks, particles, things that are still emitting radioactivity, that contamination. Well, first of all, what would you think? Obviously, they've had contamination issues already. We just don't know how widely that spread. But what do you think this looks like now over the next couple of weeks for the people who live in Japan?
Well, at this point, it's a scaled version of Chernobyl. Fission products were released, and the ones that are of concern is your cesium-137, and iodine-131. Iodine-131 is going to come out in the form of a gas, and the risk there is iodine concentrates in the thyroid. So, and most people don't even know it, but most people are iodine deficient. So your thyroid's going to suck that up like a sponge. And now you've got the problem with this concentrated iodine-131 in your thyroid, and your thyroid doesn't know the difference between iodine-121, 131. It just it's got it in there. So now you've got these radioactive iodine in your thyroid, and it's bombarding the surrounding tissue with ionizing radiation. And that, you know, some exposure causes, any exposure causes damage. Now, whether or not that damage repairs itself, you know, at some point you have so much that the cells can't repair themselves. And now you start to see, you know, blood changes, tissue changes, and you start to increase your risk of developing cancers or complications. So iodine-131 is going to be a concern. That'll be distributed by the wind. Cesium, that's a big concern. Cesium is one of these generational things. This is the nightmare scenario, because cesium gets out. It's got a long half-life. I'd have to Google it, but it's years.
It's about 30 years.
So, you know, you're looking at 150 years minimum before most of it will be gone. The thumb rules that we used in the industry were 5 half-lives, and it's essentially zero, or effectively zero. You lose about 97% of the activity after 5 half-lives. So, mm-hmm. That's 6 generations. Cesium-137 chemically just looks like calcium and potassium, and plants just suck that up. They don't know the difference. And now you get it into the food chain through the plants, and you know it concentrates either in, you know, vegetables or crop or grass that cattle graze on, and it works their way into the cow, and now you've got either, you know, meat containing radioactivity or dairy products containing radioactivity. You know, you've got issues with strontium. Strontium was an issue at Three Mile Island. That was released. That shows up in milk, and probably betraying my decayed knowledge of the periodic table, strontium, I think, looks very much like calcium. So that is going to get deposited in your bones.
Right, and how do those disperse? So if iodine's a gas, both these other things are metals, in essence. How do they get around?
Well, if you've got this venting, you're going to have particulate that's small enough that it's going to could be entrained in the steam plume, vented to atmosphere, and it goes out. You know, the heavier particles fall out quicker, but some of this stuff is small enough that it'll get picked up by the winds and can be carried for some distance. You know, Chernobyl was particularly bad because the fire was so intense, it was able to loft these clouds of burning stuff into the jet stream. And that was about as bad as it could possibly get. Without even going into a discussion of the fact that they used flammable moderator. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was, Chernobyl was a bomb waiting to happen. So far, and I will completely couch this in a so far, it doesn't appear as if any of the explosions we've seen in Japan have been enough to get a lot of material up high enough to where the jet stream could pick it up, you know. But without completely reconstructing the weather and seeing when this thermal popped along and just, you know, pulled a pocket of stuff up and kicked it up higher and higher and it got there, we don't know. But either way, you've got a gaseous emission, and it's going to start to be distributed by surface winds, and then, you know, you've got all these. I mean, Aaron might be a good guy to talk to about weather patterns and dispersal, but this stuff's going to be carried, and it's going to be carried for a while, whether it's a tropospheric confinement or if it gets up into the jet stream. I don't know if you remember, but Chernobyl took, I think it took about 10 days to get to the West Coast. We actually saw it. We were in South Carolina at the time. We saw it at about 14 days afterwards. You know, so this stuff is going to get into the air, it's going to get transported, and it's going to fall out. So, you know, depending on where it goes, what it lands on, and what the land is used for, you're going to have some concern. Now, at this point, based on what we've had so far, there will be detectable levels in the United States. I'm seeing reports come in that some of the islands in the Aleutian chain are starting to see some levels above background, as well as California. And they're consistent with what we'd expect. They're seeing iodine-131, and they're seeing cesium.
In very, very low quantities, it should be pointed out at this stage.
Right, right. But, you know, that said, you know, it's above background. And, you know, it becomes a concern because the situation isn't normal now. You could sit there and you could have, at any given day, go out in the backyard and collect a sample and count it, and it's always 70 counts per minute of activity. And that's just because of where you live and the naturally occurring radiation. That's what you get. You know, so when you start to see a departure from what you expect as normal, you know, you want to attribute that to something. And we're seeing now that, you know, there are very, very low levels that we expect to stay low, but we are seeing them. You know, and that in and of itself is cause for some concern. Not necessarily running out and, you know, consuming every potassium iodide tablet you can find. I don't know if you saw the report from the World Health Organization this morning, but worldwide they're getting reports of iodine overdose.
Yeah, I saw that. We should point out here that there should be no taking of iodine until you know, significant levels of radioactive iodine have been detected in your area. Don't want to be promoting that.
Well, it's you're balancing a risk. You know, there's no doubt in my mind that the guys in, you know, fighting the casualty have already taken and are continuing to take radioiodine.
Oh, sure. People in Japan probably ought to be doing that who live within certain boundaries. Absolutely.
I know I shouldn't say that.
All right.
We'll skip that part.
Okay. So, you know, as I look at this, though, my chief concern is we still don't really have any solid information about what's going on in those spent fuel pools or even with the cores, and I'm still struggling to find that moment where I can say, it looks like they have it under control. And I thought I had it this morning because I hadn't heard any new releases in 24 hours of them saying, oh my gosh, this is worse than we thought, or, you know, new steam plumes we didn't know about or any of that. So it felt like, you know, the more time that passes without this devolving, the better, because, you know, decaying, how it works, it felt like we're sort of on the mend. But then with the admission today that, you know, they've been, maybe things have been a lot more critical than they had suggested, and without any, this is the thing that really drives me nuts, is not having access to any good solid information. And I know my own government has probably done flyovers, and they've probably done sample collecting, and they have an isotope analysis, and they've actually measured radiation levels, and they've probably done thermal imaging so they know where the hot spots are, if any exist. All of that information would be really, really helpful, but we don't have that. So what do people do, you know, when we have to operate in this sort of fearful boundary where we can look at it? We saw Reactor 3 blow up violently, and just we know, just right away we say that wasn't good, right? What do we do when we're operating without information? What does a prudent person do in this situation, say, who lives in the Americas, West Coast? In Americas, I mean, that's from South America all the way up to the Aleutian Islands.
That's a really tough question because it depends a lot on, you know, what a person's personal risk assessment and acceptance is. Being familiar with nuclear power in the industry and the dynamics of what happens probably makes you, I won't say skeptical, but, you know, when I get a report that, you know, they're detecting radioactive contamination in San Diego, you know, through normal air particulate sampling, and you tell me what the level is and you tell me what the radionuclide is, I can say, okay, yes, statistically, that has the chance to increase my risk at some point in my life, but based on my experience, I'm not going to worry about that. You know, if you were to tell me that you had some iodine-131, you know, I would probably go find my potassium iodide tablets, but I wouldn't take them. I wouldn't take them until, you know, and you've got to balance that with the fact that most emergency response, they don't have any experience with this other than in a drill. So, you know, local emergency response and disaster control people, unless you're, you know, near an operating power plant, you know, if this was up in Coos Bay, Oregon, I'm not so sure that they're going to be all over it, you know, until it's time. So you've kind of have to have a tolerance level and a plan that, okay, they're starting to detect it. all right, I need to know where my stuff is. You know, there are people who the second somebody says iodine 131 in California, they're going to start chugging this stuff down like peanut M&Ms. And, you know, then there are people who are going to say, I don't even have a thyroid, so I don't care. And from an iodine 131 standpoint, you know, that's the right call. You don't have the worry. You know, you still have the radiation exposure from the other contaminated material that's coming, but, you know, it's all about the levels. It's all about the specific radionuclide, and all of that needs to be factored into your plan. And your plan has to be flexible and dynamic and responsive. My suspicion is that information would break after it has already become a concern in terms of, ooh, these levels are too high. People should be taking this stuff. Maybe that's just the cynic in me, you know, in the general population not being familiar with the industry. So you've got to balance that, you know, erring on the side of caution against, you know, a reasonable course of action. But your plan has to be responsive, and you have to be thinking one step ahead. What am I going to do if now all of a sudden they tell me that there's a whole bunch of cesium out there? You know, do I have enough masks? Do I have, you know, do I have enough, you know, duct tape in poly and plastic to seal up windows? Have I turned off my air conditioner? You know, that kind of stuff. You have to think about that, and you have to have your own set steps and levels of when you think you should take action. And really the best thing to do is to consult with local emergency response from wherever you go. You know, to just look and see that you're getting, you know, 240 counts in near Yosemite is going to be different than getting 240 counts in San Diego. I mean, I would expect that just from natural radiation up in Yosemite. So what is it? If you're telling me it's radon, okay, so what? Tell me it's cesium-137, completely different story.
Right, so we're down to monitoring at this point. We know there's some stuff, it's coming over. Some has already been detected. It's very, very dilute at this point. But we're still operating on low information. So how do we keep track of this? Do you feel like we're going to get information shared with us? Is this something where you should go find the local science geek from the, you know, from the lab up at Stanford and see if he can you know, share his Geiger counter with you? I mean, what do we do at this stage?
Well, there are companies out there that make, you know, personal dosimeters and radiacs that you can use on your own to do your own monitoring. You know, but again, you have to understand what's going on. You know, you can sit there and just day after day after day after day take samples and not see that 2 or 3 count per day increase until you step back and you look at all your data and you plot it. And now, you know, you look at quantitative information graphically and you see a ramp up, you see a peak, and you see it fall off. Well, it's too late then. So if you are going to get your own monitoring equipment, you need to check background. You need to check background daily. You need to check background daily in the same spot every single day. You have to operate the equipment properly. And if you walked outside and you turned a probe up, you know, into the air and allowed particulate to settle on it, well, the next day you went out there to determine your background, you know, okay, yep, it's 70 counts, and you're doing it wrong and you pick up a couple of more chunks of particulate, you know, the next day your background is 72, and it's always 72, but it's 72, 76, you know, whatever. It's going up because you're sampling wrong. You have to operate the equipment properly, and you have to understand what it's telling you. So, I mean, there's any number of sources out there where you can get your own equipment. I don't have any, and I have no intention of buying any. You know, just because of where we are in the United States, even though the number 10 most vulnerable reactor is only about 45 miles away. My own personal radiac isn't going to do me any good if Lake Anna were to have a problem. Lake Anna has a problem. I'm clearing out.
You're just going to up and leave. Yep.
I just, you know, let it run its course. And if I, you know, if I drove to my in-laws and if I didn't need to, okay, I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tough thing to do. I mean, I think you need to be ready to react. You know, radioiodine in potassium iodide tablets, you should have them just in case. but you have to understand that it's not going to protect you from all of the radiation that you're going to see from a plume. And really the best thing to do is we're not in proximity to the plant. We're not. We don't have the concern of the high levels of radiation just from a general area standpoint because of uncovered spent fuel or a breached core or whatever. We don't have the concern of those big chunks of highly radioactive material that are, you know, getting lifted and lofted through the fires and the explosions. We just aren't seeing that wide dispersal like Chernobyl yet, and hopefully we don't. So we don't have that general radiation concern, but we are going to have an elevated risk because of the way cesium-137 works. It gets into the soil, it gets into the plants get eaten by people, the plants get eaten by animals, and then we use, you know, the animals for milk or meat, and you know, it can get into us. And given the half-life, it's a problem. And so there is going to be a statistically measurable or determinable increase in risk. Very, very small, but it's going to be there. It's going to be a risk and something that we're going to have to factor in and deal with. I just don't think that the levels we're seeing at this point are really going to be anything to worry about. You know, but if somebody wants to go and scrape, you know, the top 3 inches of soil off their land and dispose of it, or, you know, get a big plow and turn everything under, you know, as far as cattle and concentration into grazing ruminant type animals, those roots are so shallow that you can scrape the upper layer of soil off, dispose of it, and you'll get most of the cesium-137. Or if you turn it under deep enough, one, you're going to be able to shield just by getting it turned under, and whatever you plant back on top of that isn't going to go deep enough that a grazing animal is going to start picking up cesium-137 that the plant picked up through its root complex. That's one of the things that they did in Chernobyl. They just literally came in and scraped 6-8 inches of soil out everywhere and drove it in, you know, to the accident site and dumped it there.
Wow, I hadn't quite gone that far in my thinking yet. So, for a moment of levity and to consider our trading people who are listening to this, you're saying go long East Coast broccoli futures?
Sure.
Because this is not something I'd really processed yet, the idea that there could be enough fallout that, you know, bioaccumulation is a very well-known process, and cesium sounds like one of those things that bioaccumulates, meaning it's relatively dispersed, but nature in its infinite wisdom accumulates it for us through predator chains or through, you know, normal accumulation processes because it mimics something that the body really wants and stores long-term, which is calcium. So we're going to have to track this very carefully. It's, you know, to me, the situation at this point in time, here we are Friday, March 18th, it's still developing. I don't know if this thing in Japan is going to drag on for another week, another day, another month. I just don't know at this stage because information's so hard to come by, but it's sure a mess. So I've got to leave it there. I really want to thank you for your time. It's just been invaluable to be able to talk to you with your experience. I am personally, my level of concern over it here in the Americas is still low, but I'm watching it very, very carefully because I just don't know what's going to happen next.
Well, this is one of the things that I've been talking about, you know, with guys at work and colleagues and old shipmates about this. You know, this is something that could turn on a dime for, you know, good or bad. You know, we've seen for a couple of days this discussion about running in a power line that will allow pumps to get power. You know, we don't know what pumps those are. My guess is they're probably emergency fill pumps that are going to take a suction on the ocean, and then either through, you know, temporary constructed piping or, you know, some jury rig, they're just going to start filling the containment buildings. The fact that they're still pursuing that causes some guarded optimism that they think they have a chance to do that, and you know, that can get the situation stabilized. You know, I'm not sure what the helicopter drops were for, and I'd be, you know, speculating at best, but it was either proofing the concept of using that as a way to get water into the building to fill the interior of the building with water and cover the core that way. I don't know.
Yeah, those concern me because visually they looked horribly ineffective. If they got 5% of the water on target, I think that was a good drop.
Well, these guys are not on any page of the book. I doubt. You know, they're in the, all right, we have got to sit down and think, what can we try next? You know, they're not in Chapter 7 of the accident response. They're past the book. I'm not going to say that they're winging it, because these are smart people. These guys know the industry, and they know the dynamics of it, you know, and they know what they can try, but you know, they just don't have a whole lot of steps left. And unless something changes drastically, you know, I don't know. We've talked about what is the worst case. You know, we clearly haven't had the worst case. It could get worse, because everything can always get worse. But I don't know that we're at a point where we can, you know, even step back and breathe deep and say, you know, I think we're in pretty good shape. I think things are stabilizing, but they're probably stabilizing as much because the plant is stabilizing itself, mm-hmm. as it's being stabilized because of the actions that the workers are taking. I think I made the comment in one of my posts that when you see them start dumping sand mm-hmm. and lead, that they have essentially admitted that they have nothing left to do, because that's what they resorted to at Chernobyl. And at that point, you know, they're just, if they start dumping sand and lead, they're one, trying to knock the radiation levels back down so that they can, you know, then slowly work their way in, assess the damage, and you know, back the cement trucks up to start filling the whole thing up and making a giant tomb out of it. You know, I think there's probably room for some guarded optimism, but you've got to understand that this thing could go south quickly. You know, what happens if there's another earthquake and whatever temporary systems that they've got rigged up fail? You know, what happens if there's another tsunami? What happens if, you know, you have a problem in a pool and these radiation levels spike again and you have to get people out of there? You know, it's both fascinating and horrifying to watch.
I agree.
It's certainly more horrifying just because of the potential for what could happen. But at the same time, you know, they're rewriting the manual right now on how this industry is going to go forward. And, you know, the lessons learned coming out of this are just be very, very interesting. And you know, who knows? Who knows where this is going to go? I'm not getting a whole lot of sleep because I'm just up consuming the news. And, you know, the first thing I do when I wake up in the morning is check email and turn on the computer and television and just start bouncing around looking for information. And, you know, like you, no news was good news. But, you know, then you saw the interview with the TEPCO director, and that, you know, doesn't give you a good feeling.
No.
So, you know, I have some guarded optimism at this point. But, you know, like you've said, if conditions change, I reserve the right to change my mind. But right now, you hate to use the media as a barometer, but they're not running with it as the top lead prime, you know, minute-to-minute-to-minute story. That's either because there's nothing coming out, or they've run out of things to talk about, which I don't believe, or what they are starting to see indicates that there's, you know, the situation has becoming a little more stable. You know, and stability in this type of accident response is good. You know, it, at least from the standpoint of it's not getting worse. And, you know, incrementally we can get this thing more stable, better, more under control. You know, but there's so many questions, there's so much information that's not out there, you know, that we don't know. But, you know, I've said it a couple times now, at this point, I have some guarded optimism more than I did yesterday, and, you know, who knows? In the time that we've done this podcast, we could turn it on and, you know, the whole thing could have gone to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, on that note, I better go check. Obviously we're going to be keeping a very close eye on it. I have not been getting a lot of sleep either, and I'll be working all weekend, obviously, because this is one of the largest events we've ever been through in this sort of an accident. I you know, people compare it to Chernobyl. I think it's past that in several regards already. When we look at the, you know, Chernobyl, for all of its faults, was a single core that went up, and here we have multiple cores potentially involved. And until it's stabilized, I'm going to be, you know, just like a cat
in a rocking chair convention. So I want to thank you again for your time, and trust that you'll be keeping an eye on this, and I will too, and we'll do the best we can to make sense of it.
All right, my pleasure.
All right, thank you, dogs. Really appreciate it.
Sure, Chris.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.